You know, I have this theory that we need more Hellraisers, not mean-spirited, aggressive, nasty types, but people who push boundaries and buttons. Christopher Hitchens was one. The gifted intellectual, writer, atheist, was pushing the limits of intellectual life, researching and reading and debating, even as his body was being ravaged by the cancer that would kill him. We were saddened when he passed away. A family lost a husband and a father. But also, I mourn the loss of the great works he would have revealed to us into the future. Things which told us about ourselves and the human condition, positions we might have disagreed with or supported, but always which added to the sum total of our knowledge. Sally Warhaft is the former editor of The Monthly, a commentator, writer and broadcaster, and she joins me now. Good morning, Sally.
Good morning, Nicole.
Sally, Christopher Hitchens said that he knew that his lifestyle would claim him, but I can't help wondering if the world could do with a few more glorious Hellraisers like, you know, Hunter S. Thompson or a couple of Jermaine Greers.
I think it sure could, particularly right now in our culture, particularly in Australia, we're finding people that will really express what they think, whether it's contrary to mainstream opinion or public polling of some kind. You know, there's just so few people that will do that. Christopher Hitchens was very special. He was brave, and he just didn't seem to really care what people thought. And the more he put his brave views out there, the more loved he was for it.
And we live in a world which is so focused, grouped, and analysed and spun. It's just so refreshing and inspirational to hear somebody who would speak as freely and as courageously as he did.
And especially somebody who spoke so beautifully, his voice. Christopher Hitchens just had this gorgeous voice, and his use of the English language was beautiful. So he had everything, really. That, you know, he was that button pusher, and but he was exceptionally intelligent and a very gifted public speaker. So he could, and writer, so he could put it all together, you know, in any forum, anywhere, and also seemed to love it. I mean, he was a man that obviously loved life, and it really is sad he's gone.
You met Christopher Hitchens a few times?
I did a few times. I was on the ABC TV's Q&A with him once, which was, you know, it's one of those things where you sort of think, why am I here or anybody else when he is here? I'm sure the audience just wanted to hear him, and I kind of did too. But I had a bit more time with him at the Sydney Writers Festival in 2010. We were both guests there, and at that time we were the only two people who were smoking.
Bad.
With all these writers. Yeah, well, I've quit and he's dead, so it's not a good thing to pursue, is it?
Okay.
But at that time, and so we shared our breakfast for sort of three mornings in a row outside.
The bad smokers.
By the water, the naughty guys.
Sally Warhaft in the naughty corner.
Yeah, although I don't know whether you could really call it breakfast, because when I sat down with him, each of these mornings he had the same breakfast, which was, I thought it was tomato juice until, of course, he told me it was half vodka. And, you know, he really lived up to his reputation. And it was at the end of that trip that he went back to America and was diagnosed with his cancer. So that was sort of the last big living it up, I think, that he had before he got ill. And you know, even when he was very, very sick and getting his treatment for his cancer and dying, he kept writing. And he wrote incredibly movingly about having cancer and about, you know, the topic of cancer, he called it, in his columns for Vanity Fair, and which he kept writing. I think the last one was published just after he died. So he just kept going and going, and people will read his work for a long, long time.
What sorts of things did you talk about with him?
Well, we talked a lot. We actually talked a lot about India, because William Dalrymple was another guest at that particular festival, and I'd done a long in-conversation interview with William. And I think Christopher was quite enamoured of William. And and so this was and he was interested in India, and so we talked about that. But he also, you know, he asked lots of questions. He liked Australia. And so, you know, we sort of rambled on about quite a few things, and just delightful conversationalist, wonderful.
Being a Hellraiser cell has consequences, doesn't it? You pushed a few boundaries in your time?
Yeah, look, I suppose, you know, I like to say what I think, and I wish more people would. I suppose it depends on, you know, what you do, though. If you're kind of not attached to particular institutions or places, or, you know, it's easier to express yourself fully. But you know, it's a bit of a disaster, I think, what's happening in a culture where you just know that, I mean, obviously politicians are the worst of this, where just nobody says really what they think anymore, and it's a very damaging thing, I think, for a culture. And I think we're seeing the effects of that. People become disengaged and cynical, and, you know, nothing improves when people talk waffle and nonsense.
But those who do lead these debates often are seen with a target on their forehead, and they are focused on by haters.
Yeah, and in that sense, we make too big a deal of it, you know, and we prevent other people from joining in. When somebody says anything at all surprising, wow, you know, it's a media story, or it's some sort of big event. It can't just be taken as somebody's ideas or views or knowledge about a topic, and so, you know, everybody makes such a big fuss that it seems unnatural, when it should be very natural. It's really, you know, we're caught, I think, in this terrible trap now. Perhaps all we need is for a couple of people in positions of power and influence, politicians particularly. I mean, imagine it. Just imagine if a couple of them got off script. And yeah. I mean, Malcolm Turnbull's been a little bit interesting, not terribly interesting on this, but a little bit more interesting than others, in that he has insisted on being honest about his thoughts on the topic that's most dear to him, which is climate change. He just won't lie about it. And I always think, well, you know, the world didn't fall in for the Liberal Party. I think they don't like it or appreciate it terribly much, but I don't think it's damaged their profile as a political party. And I think there are a lot of people across the spectrum that have a lot of respect for Turnbull for being open about it. And I think it's a pity that he doesn't take it further and be honest about other things, but others don't join in and, you know, let it gain a little momentum.
Because I suspect that we as a community understand that there are divergent views in any collection of people.
Exactly, exactly. The idea that you could have a cohort or a club or, you know, a political party and everybody agrees on everything.
Exactly, with everybody else.
Is treating people like fools, and, you know, and that's what the public are reacting to at the moment. They don't like it.
The last political hellraiser that I can think of was Bob Hawke. I just don't think that anybody who behaved in the way that he did, though, would get away with it these days. I think that the world has changed, particularly a woman. What would the world have said at that time if a woman had behaved in the same sort of way that Bob Hawke did? And he was noted for a great mind.
Yeah, I you know, he sort of dumbed himself down in a way too, but also maintained his honest extravagance of character. I think that a female politician, particularly at that time, would be far more difficult. Also unlikely, though. I think Bob Hawke, again, was a pretty singular person. I don't think he was the last Hellraiser. I think Keating was. And a female kind of Keating character, I could more see, you know, somebody that is, you know, using their intelligence in a sort of verbal way, in an intelligent way, but, you know, not afraid to sort of stand up for what they thought. I think a female could do that. I think the public would respond much, much more warmly towards the Prime Minister now, Julie Gillard, if she said, you know, I think if she came out and said, you know what, I don't like Kevin Rudd. I really don't, you know. But we work together and, you know, she said, I don't really like him. I think it's obvious we're not close. Yep. I don't think he likes me that much either, but I do respect what he's doing and we do need him. That would have a ring of truth to it. I think it would be a real problem if Kevin Rudd really was campaigning to get back into office. I think that kind of honesty, people just don't want to hear the nonsense anymore.
But the headlines the next day would be Prime Minister slams Kevin Rudd.
That's right.
And then the opposition would be, if you can't govern yourself, how can you govern the country? And around it goes.
That is the problem. But some, you sort of think of Keating, a Menzies. You know, there have been characters in public life that just would have stood up to that.
Where are the women who can, take up this battle?
Well, you wonder at the moment. I wonder where
Senator Sally Warhart.
I wonder where they are. I mean, perhaps they're there, but we don't know them. In the sense that we don't know what they're capable of, and you see different sides of politicians. You see Julie Gillard in Parliament and she's much more natural kind of performer than she is in more sort of formal prime ministerial settings. Or, you sort of wonder who else might be there that, but you know what? If they're not showing it, if they're in the Parliament, if they've got that gig, they've got those votes, if they're not going to show it now, then it'll be too late.
Do you think there would be some sort of backlash against a woman, though, taking up that sort of role?
Yeah, I'm sure there would. Yeah. I'm sure there would. But,
Because, know your place. That
live a little, I say. Have a go.
Take them on. Sally, we've also been talking about community this week, sparked by a random comment made by Tim Costello on ABC News 24 recently, in which he said he'd just returned from countries much poorer than Australia, and he was struck by their sense of community while Australia, with all its wealth and affluence, struggles with this epidemic of depression. You travelled to Bombay when studying for your PhD in anthropology, I understand. Tell me about that.
I did. I lived there for quite some time doing my field work, and I lived in a shanty settlement by the seashore with a caste of fisher people who are very low in the sort of caste system in India. But this particular group had quite a special place in Mumbai, because they're the descendants of the original inhabitants. So it'd be a bit like if we had an Aboriginal community fishing, if that was their traditional gig to go fishing in the ocean, say at Circular Quay in Sydney or at St Kilda Beach in Melbourne, really in downtown expensive part of the city, and they're economically very poor community, although they're poorer but pretty low in the hierarchy, but a very strong community. In fact, my thesis asked the question, what makes a community strong? And how come these people have survived pursuing their traditional occupation when everything is, everyone had tried to get rid of them. They live on the shore and, it's $1 million potential real estate, but in slums and shanties and
what sort of answers did you come up
with? Look, they're simple in a way, that the occupation that they did was one that is still useful.
People so meaningful still want, work.
Yeah, meaningful work that got them the necessities of life. So food, some form of shelter, covered. You can't have functioning communities where there isn't that. Tim Costello is making a point about, I suppose, communities that get so affluent that for reasons that are kind of complicated, but we all kind of know them too, it breaks down and we pursue these very individual lives and people don't know their neighbours or they don't know if their, neighbours died or, this sort of breakdown in what community is. But there's a romanticisation too to say that, community is so strong when people are in poverty or in the third world or in the developing world and there's none here. I don't by that either. Certainly, where I was in Bombay, the links were really more obviously strong. And for example, in child raising, in the slums, you know, a child is watched over by every adult that has eyes and you know, ears, and it's not the parent's sole responsibility all day to be, you know. And there was a much more fluid sort of childcare arrangements that, you know, that went on. And here, you know, in the West, I see, you know, even quite affluent mothers particularly struggling with isolation and lack of support and that sort of thing. So there are differences, and they're much more interconnected and dependent, these communities, in India that I spent time with. I think in a country like Australia, people have to work much harder to keep community and form community. Some people do it more easily than others. Sometimes it's children here that will create it, you know, people that haven't experienced before, they join parents groups or school community and that sort of thing. But it's complicated, and some of the community that you see in places where there's real economic struggle is simply because of that economic struggle. And so, you know, to romanticise it too much can be a problem, but there is no doubt that people, certainly where I lived, had access to community, a kind of a support and a community spirit, I suppose, that I've never seen the likes of in a Western city.
Is there one particular story from that time that stays with you?
Well, there are so many, but I suppose that, I mean, I it was difficult at times for me. I was there for well over a year, and you know, I missed my Australian family. I kind of felt like I had a family there too, amongst the Fisher people. But I remember, you know, what constantly overwhelmed me and struck me in that whole experience was the similarities between lives. In the end, that what people are focused on, what they're worried about, what they're enjoying in life, are the same things, and they're the really obvious things: loved ones, family, connectedness. And so, you know, that really was the sort of overwhelming thing. I mean, the magical moments were, you know, I mean, fishing in the Arabian Sea in the middle of the night, and, you know, singing, you know, traditional songs, and trying to come to terms and understand this way of life, this very different, in some ways, way of life. It was the most magical time in my life.
Oh, that sounds so wonderful. Sally Warhaf, thank you so much for coming in and sharing with us this morning.
It is an absolute pleasure, Nicole. Thank you.
Nothing like a bit of loved ones and connectedness, indeed, to bind communities together, regardless of whether you are in India or Australia.